So usually I've been trying to get up right at 5 a.m. no matter what time I go to sleep, even if I get 4 hours of sleep, because I want to get up early so I can shower in the street with water bottles and with my clothes on, and then I change in my car and there's not too many people out. And overall, I'm doing all right. You know, it's a challenge. I'm struggling with certain things, but really I just try and ignore everything around me and just focus on what I can do.
That's Angelo Mike. He lives in his car in the valley with tens of thousands of homeless people still living on the street during this pandemic. LA City and County are under increasing pressure to house them to prevent further spread of the virus and for their own safety. Yesterday, the two sides were supposed to present a plan to shelter about 7,000 homeless people who live near overpasses and freeways. Last week, a federal judge ordered them to find a way to do that, but yesterday's hearing was canceled because the city and the county couldn't agree on a plan. I spoke about this earlier with Doug Smith, senior writer for the LA Times. So basically, the judge, Judge David Carter, said this is intolerable to have 7,000 or so people living near freeways for their own health and for the health of the community. And city and county, you need to come up with a plan to house these people. But he didn't say when they had to come up with this plan or what that housing would look like.
He didn't, no. And the plans that were presented gave some indication that the city provided two plans. One was to transition out of the recreation centers, which they set up as temporary shelters, and there are roughly 1,000 people living in those now. And the other is the people who've been moved into hotels as part of Project Room Key. So that, they estimate, is about 3,000 people. And they said they could provide other housing for them, either temporary or permanent, in about 120 days. For those living under the freeway underpasses, which they estimated in the city is about 3,100, they said that would take 180 days. But because of the dispute, the judge hasn't accepted those timelines.
So that's about 6 months. That's a long time.
Yes, it is.
And they said they couldn't do it any quicker because...
It isn't an easy thing to do. I mean, the judge has made it sound like you could sort of snap your fingers and do it, but there are a lot of complications. You have to find a site for a shelter. You have to design it. You have to build it. Mayor Garcetti has established a couple of years ago a program to build a shelter in each council district, and they've now got about 20 of them open. But it takes a lot of time to do it. Sometimes you have to clear the site. You have to deal with utilities, and you have to deal with building and safety rules. So it isn't something you can just do overnight.
Right. Although they do have this Project Room Key, which is up and running, where they would put homeless people temporarily into hotel rooms. And I understand that that's at a really low capacity, that very few of these hotel rooms have actually been turned over for use to house the homeless.
They've leased about 3,500 hotel rooms, and they haven't got them all ready to open yet, but those, they have about 2,000 ready to open, and they have a total of 2,400 people in them, and that number keeps growing from day to day, but it's not going to reach 15,000. It isn't clear how high it's going to get, but 4,000 or 5,000 is probably a more realistic number. Those leases are going to expire. They have the option to renew if the hotel owners want to renew. That's quite an unknown because it depends on what the market for hotel rooms, how it trends in the next 6 months. Some people think that those rooms are going to be available for a year or longer because there isn't going to be an economic use for them. But other people think that the hotel owners are going to want them back in 90 days.
In the meantime, the city and the county are fighting over who's going to pay for this. And the city and the county are both saying, look, we're stretched thin because of coronavirus. What did the judge say about that?
He didn't say much. He just said, work it out. He said, go back and figure it out. He put the onus on them.
And they need to figure it out by when?
It isn't clear if they need to figure it out by Friday. It isn't clear what's going to happen on Friday, whether he'll postpone the order or issue the order. I think, though, the order is going to have some at least recognition that they can't just bring in a bunch of trucks and pick up people and move them somewhere else. I think that was one of the—there were flaws in the judge's order, which I think was in some sense largely symbolic. It was a way to say, you people have stalled for too long, you have to actually do something. It was a way of looking at results instead of process. But he kind of overlooked some factors that are significant, one of which is that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has concluded that it's better to leave homeless encampments alone rather than to disturb them and break them up unless you can actually move those people into individual rooms, such as Project Room Key. So the CDC is saying it's not a good idea to just move a lot of people out of encampments. And the other thing is that there's a reason people gravitate toward those freeway overpasses, because they're out of the elements when it's raining or when it's 110 degrees. They have shade and protection from the rain. And it's a place where there isn't a lot of foot traffic, so they don't have to worry so much about ADA violations where they block the sidewalks. And they're away from neighborhoods where people complain and cause the police to come out and try to harass them. So his order didn't take into consideration a lot of other factors that the city and the county have to when they start to work on removing these people from the overpasses.
So what is the bottom line here? It seems like the homeless are going to be in these places or these overpasses for a while now, perhaps as long as 6 months, while the city and county try to figure out how to house them. Is that basically what's going to happen?
I think that's probably foreseeable. I think what is going to happen also at the same time is that the judge is making it clear that he wants action. He's pushing people to do things that they've said in the past we can't do. It takes too long or costs too much money. And he's saying, I don't care. I just want you to do it. And so I think this is really chapter one of probably a series of events where the judge is going to be maneuvering. As I said, I think this was a very strong symbolic move, but he's going to be maneuvering and finding where the ideal and the practical meet. And I think that's something that will evolve over time.
Well, Doug, thank you for coming on today.
You're welcome.
Doug Smith, senior writer at the LA Times. This week, the Justice Department sent a letter to Governor Gavin Newsom warning he may be violating the Constitution by keeping churches and religious groups from gathering as part of stay-at-home orders. For weeks, churches have been pressuring Newsom to allow them to reopen. Some have even openly defied him. On Mother's Day, a parishioner attending a service at a church in Butte County exposed nearly 200 congregants to coronavirus. Now, more than 1,200 pastors have signed a petition declaring themselves essential and saying they'll open their doors on Sunday, May 31st. That's Pentecost, an important holiday for Christians. It's the day the Christian church began, they say. It's all sparked a conversation about religious freedom and the importance and necessity of faith in these turbulent times. We're going to speak now with Rob McCoy, senior pastor at Godspeak Calvary Chapel in Thousand Oaks, and one of the clergy members who signed that petition saying they'll open at the end of the month. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline. It's good to be with you.
Good to have you. Well, several federal judges here in California have ruled against churches who have brought lawsuits saying they should be allowed to reopen on First Amendment grounds. And basically, the federal judges said no. California is not being discriminatory because it's banning all public gatherings, secular or non-secular, and that B, it's unsafe for public health right now to have large gatherings. So why is it so important for your congregation to meet in person?
Well, our faith to us is essential. In a pluralistic society, I don't expect the entirety of the population of California to agree with us, and I completely understand that. As I also understand people's concern for the welfare of the community at large. And so when we did open our church on Palm Sunday for communion, our sanctuary holds 400 seats, but we had 10 seats available and people lined up with social distancing 6 feet apart. And communion, which typically takes 20 minutes, took over 3 hours. And so we were very, very concerned with protecting the community and abiding by CDC standards. So we have no desire to threaten the health of our community. But in the same regard, our faith is critically essential to us. And unlike a cannabis distributor or a liquor store or a bicycle repair shop or a realtor, we, like you, are entwined in the same First Amendment. with the freedom of the press and the freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom to peaceably assemble. And so a pandemic doesn't allow constitutional rights to be suppressed. But in the same regard, we also see the consequences of this lockdown, that we've got domestic violence and depression and suicide and economic malaise. And so we just want to tend to the congregation to help them.
Right. So you're saying that from a health perspective, you're actually offering something to improve the health of your congregants, taking on the argument that what you could be doing is exposing your congregants to something that's unhealthy. You're saying that this is actually a preventative measure.
Exactly. And thank you for clarifying that, because there is something significant about human interaction, to be able to see someone's face and smile and to greet one another. I mean, we're creatures of community. We're relational, and it's critical.
Well, the governor says that this is temporary, that this is not going to last forever. It's not even going to last for, you know, the better part of a year. He says that he may ease restrictions in a matter of weeks. So why not wait and see what the governor proposes before deciding to defy state orders?
That's a great question, and one that we have strongly considered. First, we were told that we had to flatten the curve, which we did. We were told that we had to limit the hospitals from being overrun, which we accomplished. And each time we're given a date, it extends further. So for us, we typically do communion the first Sunday of the month, which we practiced on Palm Sunday. And then we were supposed to do it May 3rd, and then we waited till the 10th, and then we waited till the 24th. So we've been patient, but we're now coming up to the last Sunday of May, and communion for us is essential. It's one of the two sacraments of our faith, and we can abide in this essential capacity by maintaining CDC standards as a Costco or a Trader Joe's or anyone else would do. But this is essential to our faith, and we want the governor to acknowledge that, and he hasn't.
But the difference is, and the difference between a Costco or a Safeway and a church is, you go into a Costco or a Safeway for a very short period of time, very few people are allowed in, and then they're out. At a church service, you just said that there was a 3-hour long communion. That is a long period of time for people to be all together in one place.
That description sounds on the surface correct. However, if you think about a Costco, when I was describing a communion service, they're in a line outside waiting to come in for one of the 10 seats, of which they occupy for a very short period of time. So it wasn't any different than a Costco or Trader Joe's on Palm Sunday. But along the lines of your description, yes, they will be in the sanctuary for a longer period of time on May 31st. But also the threat and the danger is far less than it was back in April. And then in addition, they're going to maintain social distancing. So that's one of those areas where we will maintain protection.
How many people will be there on May 31st?
So in accordance with CDC standards, based on the square footage of our facility, we have to operate less than 100 in our 18,000 square foot facility, which we'll maintain. And that's why, instead of doing one service, we'll do three to accommodate folks over the course of the day.
So three services with 100 people in each.
Exactly.
And will they be wearing masks?
Yes. The masks will be provided. They will be encouraged. But of course, they're not demanded. And that's one of those things where I imagine, like on Palm Sunday, everyone wore one. But, we had the sheriff's department there that we invited. And if they were concerned that anyone's health was at risk, we told them immediately, you can shut us down. And they didn't. They saw that we were abiding by the standard.
Are you also heartened and emboldened, if I may use that word, by the announcement earlier this week that the Justice Department came out warning California it's violating the Constitution by banning religious gatherings?
Well, I wouldn't say emboldened. I'm comforted by the fact that there are others that consider along the lines of what I've believed, that yes, the federal government may have ruled in a certain capacity or it's stated an order. However, honestly, it's irrelevant to what we're trying to do in California. I'm up in Sacramento now. I'm trying to appeal to the governor. We want to be on the same page. we want him to recognize there are 15 million self-professing evangelical Christians in California, the state of 40 million. That's a constituency that needs to be addressed. And seldom are we addressed in any of his comments. And so we're not being prideful or overly bold. This is essential to us. And I know it's going to come at a cost. I mean, I resigned my position on the city council knowing that I'd be violating a state and county ordinance. And I didn't want to put my fellow colleagues in a difficult position. So I resigned from a position I held that I loved and a community that I love serving. But this is essential to us.
And again, you can practice your religion. No one's saying that that is being forbidden. It's just being amended in terms of how you do it. No one's saying you can't be religious or practice your faith or whatever it is, but you could do it over Zoom. You could do it in the privacy of your own home.
Well, that's like having, I love the illustration. It's like having a picture of a fireplace on your computer screen or sitting in front of a warm fire. They're two totally different things. And for us, our faith is practiced in community. Communion, the word itself, which is our sacrament, is community, the body and blood of Christ. I don't expect everyone to agree or even completely understand it, but again, I'm emphasizing that this is our life.
Pastor Rob McCoy from Godspeak Calvary Chapel in Thousand Oaks, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, traffic is creeping back. Could that actually be a good thing? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. LA is still under stay-at-home orders, so freeways and streets should be empty, right? Or at least very sparse. Well, if you've been on the roads lately, you know that's not the case. Traffic is still down in LA overall, but it has definitely increased since the early days of shelter in place. Joining me to talk about this is Michael Manville, Associate Professor of Urban Planning at UCLA, where he leads their traffic congestion program. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're at home, I'm at home, but it seems like a lot of people aren't at home. What does traffic look like today and these days in general?
Well, as you said, I mean, it's still well below what we would be experiencing in non-COVID times. I think that, but it is up a bit from its sort of the absolute valley it fell to right after the stay-at-home orders were first put in place. And so I think that's become very noticeable because I think it was so profoundly shocking when the roads were virtually empty right after we all started to shelter in place, or many of us started to shelter in place. And now, of course, you find yourself looking at roads and seeing that, you know, at first you're just kind of like, is this just me? You know, but yes, the numbers are creeping up. And I think we just noticed that because they had been so low.
Well, also I wonder who are these people, and they're not essential workers, all of them. What are they doing in the roads?
Yeah, and you know, to be honest, that's something that we just don't know. We know from data from firms like INRIX or Google cell phone data, and we know from Caltrans's own sort of sensor data, although that comes out a little bit slower, that more people are on the roads. What we can only speculate as to who they are and where they're going. And, you know, I mean, I think most people would arrive at the same sort of informed speculation as I would, which is to say that it's some combination of some more businesses and especially some more recreation areas reopening, right? Now we have some more trails that are open. The beaches are
and
open.
The beaches, yeah.
We've got a few more businesses that are doing curbside. And then that just combined with, for better or worse, quarantine fatigue, where, you know, initially I think everybody was, or almost everybody was willing to just kind of hunker down and try and ride this out. And then human nature starts to creep in, and folks don't like being cooped up in their homes mm-hmm. quite as much. And so they're either going out just for a drive, or they're going to some other part of the region to walk around or to have a social distance visit with friends they haven't seen in a long time. And the nature of traffic is that all that sort of accumulates slowly but steadily, and then you see it on the road as a little bit more delay.
And it does seem like a lot of people are speeding a lot out there. Has that corroborated with real data?
Yeah, I think that, you know, well, certainly average speeds are just way up. You know, I think before the COVID crisis, it would take, you know, if you were to drive from Long Beach to where I work at UCLA, I think your average speed on the 405 would be about 18 miles an hour. And then, all of a sudden that shot up to 70 miles an hour, and that's an average speed. And so we should not be surprised by that prevalence of speeding, because I think one thing that is really being demonstrated by the shelter-in-place order is that in Los Angeles, the biggest constraint on vehicle speed was traffic congestion. You know, we have roads that have been designed to just handle a steadily increasing amount of vehicle traffic. So we have these very wide roads. You know, the 405 is the obvious example, but even if you look at our surface arterial streets like Venice Boulevard on the west side, I mean, these are streets that are designed in many ways to move traffic at 50 or 60 miles an hour. And the reason they don't is that they're usually just clogged with cars. And so when most of those cars disappear, it's awfully easy to go awfully fast.
Yeah. And so are we seeing more accidents because of that?
If you look at, you know, sort of statewide numbers and Southern California numbers sort of bear this out too, the total number of collisions is down. And that's because most collisions occur just because of congestion, right? The typical collision is there's a big density of vehicles, and so the chances of two of those vehicles coming in contact with each other is higher. And most of the numbers I've seen suggest that sort of if you just look at all collisions combined, they're down just because there's fewer cars out there. That said, the most dangerous type of collisions, right, which are the collisions that happen when vehicles are traveling at high speed, that seems to have not fallen, or at least not fallen by nearly as much, right? And so it is this important distinction to draw between, you know, collisions in general, which includes a lot of kind of low-speed collisions that can be very stressful and they can result in property damage, and the types of collisions that would lead to, serious injury or death. And those involve high speed. And again, we've made high speed much, much easier as a result of this order.
Do you think that there will be any meaningful change to traffic once we've come out of stay-at-home orders?
I don't like to get into the business of predicting what policymakers will do. So what I will say
is... But do you think more
is...
people would stay at home because they realize they can live their life okay without going into traffic as much?
Oh, wow. No, I don't. I think that for some people that could happen, right? I think there's going to be some people who are going to say to themselves, you know what, this whole staying at home thing wasn't as bad as I thought it was, and I can actually work from home and be productive or whatever. I think that's going to be counterbalanced by some people who, as soon as this order is lifted, they're like, let me out of here. and I also think this just boils down to, we do live in a very interconnected economy, right? A very interconnected society. And to the extent we ramp that back up, we are going to ramp back up that need for people to be in close proximity to one another.
Michael Manville is an associate professor of urban planning at UCLA, where he leads the university's traffic congestion program. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Coming up, one of the most foremost experts on Mexican cooking happens to be a British woman.
She made these massive sandwiches, tortas, and just layered with ingredients, tomatoes from her garden, lettuce, different types of cheeses, ham, avocado, black beans that she had made with lard, these huge rolls that were the size of a football.
Diana Kennedy has made it her mission to tell the world about the many layers of Mexican cuisine. Her story next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Mexican food is one of the oldest and most complex cuisines in the world. But one of the foremost authorities on Mexican food is actually a white woman from Britain.
I've had young chefs saying to me, oh, she's English. I know my grandmother. They've all got grandmothers now, you see. So I said, well, sonny boy, when I came to Mexico, you were this high, and I was cooking with your grandmothers. You seem to forget that.
Diana Kennedy was one of the first people to document all of Mexico's regional cuisines, from the deserts of Sonora to the streets of Mexico City to the jungles of Yucatan. She has published 9 cookbooks, won 2 James Beard Awards, and was awarded the Order of the Aztec Eagle, Mexico's highest honor for foreigners. She is 97 years old and lives on her own in a house she built in Michoacan. Her life is the subject of a new documentary called Diana Kennedy, Nothing Fancy, Nothing Fancy, the title of one of her cookbooks. The film is a finalist for this year's James Beard Awards. It's directed by Elizabeth Carroll, and Elizabeth joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. Well, we had initially planned to also have Diana on with you in this interview, but coronavirus happened. Where is she right now?
She's at home at her house in Michoacan.
Well, she's 97 years old, and in the movie, she doesn't seem to nothing stops her. She's just seems indefatigable. How did you meet her and get interested in doing this documentary?
It was kind of a serendipitous event when we met. I was living in Austin, Texas in late 2013, and I was hoping to make a film about the matriarchy of food culture in Mexico and what that looked like through a contemporary lens. And then I came across Diana, and I kind of, you know, remembered hearing her name in passing, but had never really known or understood the breadth of her work and her research. So when I came across her, I just really wanted to interview her for this possible project. And so I kind of looked around for clues as to how I could find her email address or how I could get in touch with her. But I didn't really find anything that day. So I left the coffee shop where I was working, and I went to a bookstore, looked up at the marquee, and it said, book signing with Diana Kennedy tomorrow.
Wow, that is fortuitous. And that's where you met?
Yeah, so we met there the next day. The people at the bookstore gave me an email, you know, for her publicist. So I went home and I wrote that email, and I basically said, you know, if you'd be willing to interview or just talk to me briefly for this project, I would be really happy to have you. And then when I went in the next day to meet her, and she turned around and she says, oh yes, you're the woman who wants to make the film about me.
And so on. There it happened. She basically got you to do a film about her.
Pretty much. Yeah. It was a happy accident for both of us in a way.
Well, she has been an institution in the food world for a long, long time. And talk about how she got started. How did she end up in Mexico in the first place?
She grew up in England, ended up emigrating to Canada after World War II. During World War II, she worked in the Women's Timber Corps cutting down trees. She ended up going to Canada. And then somebody invited her on a trip to the Caribbean in 1957. She's on that trip, and then I think she took kind of a solo mission in one direction. And she ended up at a hotel in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, walked into the lobby, and says that it was at that moment that she met her future husband, Paul Kennedy, who was a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. And he was based in Mexico City at the time. So he invited her to come and live with him. And I think that was the beginning. You know, that was the first time that she'd been exposed to the richness of culture and the vibrancy of that universe there. And I think she fell in love with the culture and the cuisine and started cooking.
Hmm. So there she is, falling in love with the Mexican cuisine. And her husband is a foreign correspondent, so he's traveling a lot. And we have a clip from your movie where she talks about what she would do when he would be off reporting.
The minute I arrived in Mexico, I would be off to the markets looking at things. When he was off on his trips, I would get on third-class buses and start wandering around Mexico and look at the food and the markets. To me, that was the most exciting part, and I thought that is the key to Mexican food and the key to the rural life of Mexico coming into the city.
What was it about the food that she found so enthralling?
I think that Mexican culture and Mexican cuisine is so much richer, more vibrant, more interesting, more varied, more diverse, certainly than British food that she was accustomed to, and certainly American food. And so I think, you know, to discover something in that organic way, so to speak, has to be enthralling when you already have a passion for, you know, cooking or a comfortability of being in the kitchen. It must have been really interesting to notice as she traveled that, you know, the regional cuisines were so fundamentally unique from one another, and that she would go to one area and taste ingredients and recipes there that were fundamentally different from what she would taste on the other side of the country.
And so she wrote a lot of cookbooks, and they really caught on, especially amongst other chefs. And so was she seen, is she seen as the interpreter of Mexican food in the cooking world?
I think that for an English-speaking audience, she was the first person to translate regional Mexican recipes and regional Mexican cuisine to an English-speaking audience. And up to that point, there were only tacos and burritos in the U.S. Nobody really had a conception for what Mexican food was beyond those basic elements. And I think that, she, you know, Diana was the first person to illuminate that this cuisine and this world was much, much broader and much richer and deeper than anyone had known who wasn't Mexican up to that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, is that a problem that here she is, this white British woman interpreting Mexican cuisine, and people take her seriously and not necessarily haven't really taken or listened to Mexican chefs or Mexican experts on their own cooking?
I think that at that time, there were not necessarily, as there are now, now there are hundreds and hundreds of amazing Mexican chefs who, you know, can tell you every single thing you could possibly want to know about every region of Mexican cuisine. But I think that perhaps at that time, there was not per se, you know, one person or multiple people who could speak to the regional cuisine of Mexico in terms of all of the different regions of Mexico and have a sense of mastery over all of those different styles of cooking. Mm-hmm. And I think that at that time, the way that Diana pursued her research and pursued the information and the recipes was more so with the intention of anthropologically recording the recipes and the ingredients that were being used to make sure that none of them would be lost on the record of history.
Here is another clip from your movie where she is making guacamole, and she's doing it for you in her house, and you cut the scene of her making the guacamole for you with old footage from her television show where she's making guacamole for an audience. So let's listen to that.
I'm going to do it the traditional way. No, you don't put garlic in, and you don't put kosher salt. Let's get it right. I'm using a molcajete. You may not have a molcajete, but buy one. You know, it's just as easy to cook it the proper way. We're going to put some finely chopped white onion. Not minced. For goodness sake, everybody minces everything and they leave all the juice on the board.
I'm going to put some finely chopped chili serrano.
Keep your hands off the jalapenos, por favor. No jalapenos.
Here's a little chili serrano.
These happen to be from the garden. They're totally organic. They're a little bit small, but what the hell?
With seeds and veins, don't stop and take those out, because that's crazy.
Anybody who says take the seeds out of the serrano, well, they're not very good cooks.
Then with some roughly chopped cilantro.
People say don't like cilantro. Please don't invite them.
She's not shy about expressing herself, for sure. Has she always been that way?
As long as I've known her, for sure, definitely.
How is she received in Mexico? Is there anyone who is critical of her in terms of, I don't know, cultural appropriation or making a career and a successful career out of that? Or is she seen more as someone who is kind of like an adopted daughter?
I think for the most part, you know, I've asked a lot of people this question. And it seems to me that most people, especially those who are involved in the food world, do view her as an adopted daughter and are really grateful to Diana for the efforts that she's put forth to solidify recipes, ingredients, and these pieces of culinary history and cultural history to make sure that those are, you know, there forever. And I think that certainly some people don't like her. And, you know, I think that there's sort of a mixture of different opinions, but from what I've come to understand, I think most people really appreciate what she's done.
Her husband died fairly young, right? In the 60s. Is that correct?
Yes.
And she never remarried after that.
Right.
She never had children. Why not?
I think that Diana is so fiercely independent, and she's ironically a very sex positive person at the same time. And she never shied away from having lovers or even talking about the importance of having a lover and how good that can be for your brain. I've always admired that about her, but I think that she never wanted anything to get in the way of her independence and her being able to do what she wanted to do and what she set out to do, which in this case and in this life for her was, you know, researching Mexico and cooking Mexican food. And that became her passion and her life's work. And I think to her, you know, she said that she happened to meet the love of her life. And of course they would get married because of that. But she said she never would have gotten married if she hadn't met Paul.
So when you were shooting at her house, would she cook for you? And was there a meal that she cooked for you where you thought, oh my gosh, I've never tasted anything like this?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, you know, I think she viewed cooking for us, for me and my crew, as just very, you know, practical stuff. She was not there to entertain us by any means. We were there, we all had a job to do, and she maybe more than all of us felt that way, but she would ultimately usually provide something. And I just remember the first time we went there, she gave us she made these massive sandwiches, tortas, and just layered with ingredients, tomatoes from her garden, lettuce, different types of cheeses, ham, avocado, black beans that she had made with lard, these huge rolls that were the size of a football. And it was one of the best things I've ever eaten in my life.
That sounds so good. Wow. And she's 97. What does she attribute her longevity and her health? Because she seems pretty healthy.
She is. She's incredibly healthy. I asked her that so many times because I hoped to always get a different answer and I could somehow come up with a strategy on how to age well the Diana Kennedy way. But I think, you know, every time I would ask her, she would say, well, you know, I stopped smoking during World War II. So that was a big one. And then she says, you know, I don't drink very much. I only have one scotch a week on Saturdays while I sunbathe on my balcony nude and listen to the opera. I think that ultimately, to be somebody who's so driven and so focused on what she cared about and what she wanted to create and what she wanted to produce, you know, perhaps there's a connection between having that kind of fire for being alive.
The nude sunbathing with the opera doesn't hurt either.
Right. Yeah, I think she has her simple pleasures and she knows when to take them.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today about her.
Thank you very much.
Elizabeth Carroll, she's director of the new documentary, Diana Kennedy, Nothing Fancy. You can stream Diana Kennedy, Nothing Fancy, starting tomorrow on Virtual Cinema. Coming up, another food maven, our own Evan Kleiman, is here to tell you where to get great pizza. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Time now for our weekly Cooking with Evan food segment.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lunch?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom, flames.
Bam, that's a little bad like that.
Pie.
Well, it's been months since the days of gathering with friends and ordering a large pizza pie. But that doesn't mean your pizza cravings have to go unanswered. In fact, now might be the time to try your hand at making pizza yourself. Evan Kleiman is here. Hi.
Hi. Yes, it's the easiest thing to do.
Okay, we'll get to that in a second. But first, if you're just feeling a little like, I just want to call and get one delivered, there's so many different kinds of pizza out there. What's your favorite kind?
There's so many kinds that saying pizza means one thing to one person, one very different thing to somebody else. My favorite kind is the kind that I made for 30 years. So ours was sort of like a hybrid of Neapolitan and Roman pizza. It was thin-ish, but it wasn't like sourdough. It was just made with yeast, and it was just enough crunch, but then you would bite through and then you would hit yielding dough and sparely topped. It was good. And what's so interesting about right now is we're kind of having a pandemic pizza moment in that, you know, all the pizza places were uniquely positioned to just immediately pivot and keep doing what they do, which is deliver and make pizzas for pickup. And a lot of people, either young people who have been playing around with wanting to get into the game, and established places that never made pizza, that pizza wasn't on their menu, turned to pizza as an easy thing for them to do with very limited staff. And that would hold up well being taken home. Mm-hmm. So I've put together a list that introduces you to some newcomers and some veterans who are making pizzas for the first time out of their restaurants.
Okay, well, let us in on some of these people. Who are they?
Well, I would say the veterans are so interesting. Chef Chad Colby, who for years was at Kispaka and now has his own marvelous place called Antico on Beverly, is making a large format pizza on a focaccia base. So it's like a pan pizza. He changes toppings. Bill Addison, the critic for the LA Times, said that the toppings range from austere to ornate. So that's a pie that you would buy for a family. It's really big. Then Fred Eric of Fred 62 on Vermont, he's launched LA style pan pizza, which is another pan pizza that he's doing that looks, you know, really cheesy. Pepperoni features quite widely on a lot of these pan pizzas around town. And then I wanted to introduce you to a couple newcomers. Brandon Gray, he's also part of the Secret Lasagna crew. At Secret Lasagna, he just started making these pizzas And he's decided to like go full bore. So he's created a brand called Brandoni Pepperoni. And they're great. It's a sourdough pizza base. And then he just does beautiful seasonal toppings. Then there's another pandemic pizza who actually are going under the name Quarantine Pizza. Mm-hmm. And they're pies from a young couple doing pickup in Highland Park that are really good and quite beautiful.
And what are their pizzas like?
They're more like a regular personal size pizza that you would expect to get. All these folks, the toppings change, and Instagram is definitely their menu. So that's where you want to go to see what choices you have. A lot of these places, like a lot of places right now, you need to communicate with them through Instagram or you just call.
And what if you want to make your own pizza? What do you need to do? It seems a little intimidating, I'll be frank, to make a good pizza dough.
So if you're not quite up to making your own pizza dough, but you want to do pizza like as a project with whoever you're safer at home with, there are some great kits out there that you can get that include dough and lots of different toppings. And that's really fun. So one of those is Urban Pie, LA. Jason Winters ran a trio of mobile pizza rigs, and now he's doing curbside pie pickup and DIY kits that also you can get delivered. And it's really extensive. He sent me one so I could see what it was like, and I handed it off to my neighbors who had less experience than I to see how they dealt with it, and they loved it. Also,
what does it entail? Do you have to actually, the dough's already made for you, you just have to spread it out and cook it?
Exactly. You spread it out, you put all the toppings on, and then you slide it into your oven and cook it. I want to give a shout out to another DIY kit. Inez Glazer, she was a former line cook at the now shuttered Soto, which made incredible pizzas, and she's offering pizza party kits. She has a DIY shop that lets you choose from different things. I think that if you get, most of us are used to, or a lot of us, you know, we'll go to Trader Joe's or we'll go to a store and we'll just buy dough. A lot of that dough is made to last a long time, and so it's very sturdy. And for example, my dough is the opposite of that. My pizza dough is pretty fragile. It's very soft. And it's really easy to spread out. I mean, you barely need to stretch it because gravity kind of does a lot of the work for you. And I've done a lot of the work by writing up a recipe.
So your recipe, we're not going to get into it right now, but it's on your Instagram page. You'll have the recipe there for your pizza dough. Okay. Do you need a pizza stone or can you just cook it on anything in your oven?
You don't need a pizza stone. You know, famously, I don't really have an oven. I have, you know, a countertop oven I've been using for like 30 years. And I use just a little round plaque that has holes in it. And I use that to bake my pizzas in my toaster oven. A stone is great. Strangely enough, a pizza steel, which is a new kind of thing, is even better because it retains even more heat. But you can just throw a cookie sheet in your oven and heat it up with your oven and then slide the pizza onto the oven. One of the things I talk about in my recipe is there are two tools that I think make your life much easier when you're making pizza. One is a bench scraper, which is useful if you do any kind of bread baking or baking at all. And the other, and that you use to cut your dough and to move the dough around and also clean off your surface. And the other is a wooden pizza peel. And that's a giant spatula on which you form the pizza and then slide it onto the stone or whatever you're using to bake it on. And that, I think, is pretty key. Also, you know what you can do with pizza, if you don't want to deal with your oven, is you can grill them. And it's that, we're almost at that time of year when we want to fire up the grill. You just take the dough and throw it on your hot grill and then put the toppings on and close the lid.
Oh, wow. That seems really easy. Even I can do that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food and our regular cooking expert here on Press Play. Thank you, Evan.
My pleasure, Madeline.
And if you want Evan's recipe for pizza dough or the list of restaurants and pizza kits she mentioned, just go to our website, kcrw.com. I'm Madeline Bram. I'll see you tomorrow.